weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 254 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I know that Halloween is over, but some horror books just call out for attention any time of the year. And that's what's going on with Tainted Love, a terrific book by David Carr and John Hernandez. We talk about how the book came to be, who the characters are, how the art came to be, and what has happened to make that art stand out, as well as what makes this whole vampire story unique. We get into what they have in store for us as well, so I'm sure you're going to want to listen to what they have to say. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast David Carr and John Hernandez, creators of a really great vampire book called Tainted Love. And I got to meet you guys at Baltimore Comic Con recently, and I saw the books and I really loved them. And so we're going to start talking with you, Dave, and then we'll talk with John later on about the artwork and stuff. But David, why don't you tell us about, of course, you've got that name Tainted Love, which is going to make people think of a certain song. And I was just kind of curious, did the song come into play with this? How did this get involved with your writing of the book?
Well, sure, Wayne. Well, first of all, thanks for having us on. Mm-hmm. So, I will definitely say that the music that plays over most of the writing and what the story is about, I would definitely say a lot of it comes from the 80s in tone and style and the feel of what I hear and what I'm writing. But directly, the title is more about the relationship between the two main characters. But basically, the story is, you know, a pair of people that were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and this happened to them, and they became vampires. Now they have to live with this disability, I guess, for a lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. And it's not a world filled with vampires or anything like that. It'd be like our time, mm-hmm. where we don't believe in that sort of thing. And so they are stuck with something that is not prevalently around them. They don't know the rules of what it would be to be this, other than, I guess, our own folklore and, you know, media and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. This is something completely new to them, or would be new to us. And over time, what they realize is, they just, because they're vampires doesn't mean that anything that their normal life has gone away. I mean, yes, life is no longer normal, but they still have to pay the bills. They still have family. They still have to watch their, you know, their sister's kids on the weekend. Their life didn't all of a sudden change and become, you know, these vampires that now live in Transylvania and they live in Kaufman's and have a big mansion and all this kind of thing. No, they still have an apartment, a 800 square foot apartment and a mortgage, and they've got two jobs they got to wrestle with and everything else in between. And oh, by the way, you also have to kill people and drink their blood or what have you, you know. So it adds a weird kind of facet or layer to what would normally be normal life for us. Mm-hmm. So in that context, you know, like when you're reading, even in the first couple comics we've done, let's say there would be like this moment where there's sweet moments where you just have the characters like in their romantic relationship, but at the same time, while they're having this sweet sharing couples moment, they might also be stripping down a body and preparing it to feed. You know, so like there's this horrific violence, you know, coupled in with this kind of sweet moments, and I guess that's kind of where the tainted love element comes into play.
Okay. Now, one of the things I'm interested in, because you're going into a place that a lot of people have gone to before, and that's, of course, vampires. And yet, I was reading in some of your stuff where you said that you feel there are things about your story that makes yours stand out from, say, Tom Cruise or other kinds of stories. What are the things that make this story different, and why do a vampire story at this point?
What the initial differences someone would think of would be, what are the rules for this vampire per se, or what would be the normal romanticized folklore of vampires opposed to what, let's say, how I would view vampires or my take on the issue. Really, for me, it's not so much about vampires. Really, for me, it's about the idea of two people being forced to be in a situation that they didn't ask to bring upon themselves. They didn't necessarily choose it, but this has happened to them, and they have to live with it. They have to live with the guilt of what it is. They have to come to terms with what they are. Maybe they go through moments of denial and guilt before they reach areas of, let's say, like acceptance, because at some point, if they can't change what they are, but they're going to keep living, then maybe they just have to accept what they are. And then maybe, who knows, maybe when you cross over acceptance, they may get into an area of maybe they enjoy it, maybe they hate it. I don't know, but they still have to come to a place of understanding what it is that they are and eventually embracing what it is if they're going to continue to live and have a life, you know?
This sounds almost allegorical to me, like as if you're talking about certain people in society who are not necessarily accepted by society, and yet they had their love brings them through all this situation. I get a large vibe of that when you were talking about that.
Yeah, I would say that that's definitely there in the background. I mean, originally, the funny thing was, the original draft of what Tainted Love was about actually wasn't a vampire story at all. It was actually a couple that was living together in their disability, or wasn't so much a disability, but what was wrong with them was they both had AIDS, and she was a nurse, and she inadvertently contracted AIDS, you know, helping one of the patients, and then she came home and passed it over to her husband or significant other, and then together they had to live with the disease and what it was. But at the same time, in the period that I was writing it, like in the tone, it would have been more like in the late 80s, and the tone would have been more like how the society would have shunned them or would have had certain feelings or thinking about how this happened to them or what they would be or if it was their fault or all those kind of things. And then, of course, it was, you know, let's say the character of Sarah would have to live with the guilt of having given it to her husband, even though it wasn't really her fault. It's just the nature of what it was. But then I realized after writing a story like that, it was so depressing and morbid. And I was trying to think, like, who the hell is going to read, you know, like a story about people that got AIDS. And at the time, I just thought, like, yeah, okay, this is totally the wrong direction. But in a way, changing it over, at least at first, to being a story kind of about vampires was a way to still explore the same idea of guilt. In this case, which maybe isn't so clear yet, not from the comic book, but once we delve into the past, maybe it's like a reversal. Like maybe Daniel's the one that gets bit and then he contracts it over to Sarah or what have you. But it's still dealing with the same issues of guilt and, you know, feeling you did this to someone you love. And then also together you have to live in this horror. But then maybe at some point you decide maybe it's not as bad as you think it is. And that's kind of interesting how we might get there, but especially because, you know, Sarah has kind of like a Catholic background, and so there's lots of extra Catholic guilt and other things that might come into play when in regards to, like, you know, maybe murdering another human being or something like that, another layer added on top of this kind of concept. But in reality, it was exploring for me as a writer the same kind of issues and things that I wanted to talk about, and it even added this extra layer of maybe, like, hidden sin, like a couple that knows each other so well that together they share a sin that they don't want the world to know, but yet they still delve into it, was weirdly cryptic and also kind of fun to explore. So, I mean, so for me as a writer, that's what led me down the road. It wasn't so much about vampires. I'm not like a huge vampire fan, or honestly, I haven't even seen most of the vampire movies or read any of the books or anything like that. I mean, like, I've seen a few. You mentioned Tom Cruise. I did at some point, I guess it would have been in the early 90s, I did see Interview with a Vampire once. But that's very romanticized kind of vampirism. And not that that isn't fun and not that the movie wasn't good. I mean, it's a Neil Jordan film and he's a fantastic filmmaker. And I don't mind the film at all or anything like that. But it was just, it's a very different thing from what personally I'm attracted to or about the idea of the story. I mean, having a horror element in there, though, is a lot of fun as well. So I figure people can connect with that. And just because we've had tons of other stories about other types of monster movies or horror ideas doesn't mean that writing one today couldn't be pertinent or fresh or new or maybe revitalize something, especially maybe a franchise like vampirism. Whereas when I first started writing this story, the very first draft of this story was back in like 2004. There was no True Blood. There was no Twilight. There wasn't, I don't know, all the other vampire stuff that came out since then that was just like a plethora of it. We literally just got bombarded with it over our head, beat over our head with this stuff. And unfortunately for vampires, a lot of that material didn't go so well. A lot of people didn't take to it. They thought different reasons people were not fans of it, or they weren't fans, you know, like in the sense of Twilight, that became more of like a tweeny audience that embraced it. It wasn't so much for the vampirism of it or what you would imagine, like the horror element of what that would be about. So as opposed to, like, let's say something like zombies, for example, where you have, you know, the audiences that love like Walking Dead. And a lot of the zombie movies that are coming out, like, are things that preceded Walking Dead, like stuff like, especially stuff like 28 Days Later, for example, a fantastic Danny Boyle movie, where you have things that, like, when they did that kind of genre, they did it really well, as opposed to maybe some of the stuff that we had for vampirism that short amount of time that maybe didn't fare as well with audiences, you know? So I guess maybe if it was a different day or something different happened, maybe, I don't know, maybe it wouldn't be as pertinent to do a vampire story. But I guess I just felt like even during that whole run of stuff that I was seeing about vampires and stuff that came out, there was very little that interested me, or I felt like if I was going to be a fan of just vampire genre in general, like that they had hit the nail on the head for me, I just didn't feel like that happened. So I still felt like it was worthwhile to tell my story, even though I had told it, you know, I'd written it more than a decade ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, people always criticize me. I don't get to it soon enough. How do people get a hold of Tainted Love? I know you've got a prequel webcomic out, and you've also got – we saw two issues at Baltimore Comic Con. How do you go to the prequel webcomic? That might be a good place to start.
So you just go right to our website. It's www.taintedlovecomic.com. And right there, it's on there for free, and it's like a moving motion comic that John created. It's something that we really have never seen before. I don't feel anybody's done it quite the way we did it, but it's still got the comic book panel style of comic book storytelling that John and I are both very much endeared with and love. But at the same time, it also has like movement to it and dialogue that rotates and just some really fun stuff. It's very cinematic, and I feel Tainted Love is definitely a cinematic kind of story. You know, I've written around the Tainted Love comic book. I've written other screenplays and things over the years. So it definitely was at first kind of thought of in a cinematic kind of way.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so you go to the website to get those. How about like paper versions of the book? How do you get those?
So on our website, we will have little – they're kind of like – I mean, we didn't really do any kind of Kickstarter or anything like that, but a, like kind of like supporting kind of packs where you can buy, you know, like a poster and mm-hmm. some of the comics and stuff like that in a whole pack together. Mm-hmm. And for people who go to our website right there with the comic book and they buy those packs, they run around the $25 to $30 range mm-hmm. type thing, but you also get like your name in print in the back of the comic book as like a supporter, and there's a whole lot of other parts involved to that. If you just want to buy like an individual comic book or check it out that way, the best way to catch us is actually at whatever shows we're going to set up at the moment. We are in some stores, but it's mostly just within the DMV area. So if you live, you know, Maryland, DC, Virginia, any of those areas, there are some stores that carry it. Probably our primary home store that supports us is Flashback Comics in Woodbridge.
Okay.
So if you really had to get it, you could get a hold of them. There's a way to get it that way. But I guess it just really depends on where you're at. You can always email us on the website, and we can always try to find a way to get to you and make it accessible to you. But for now, it's pretty much just at the shows, like the way you saw it with us. And, I mean, we weren't in a really great spot at the show because of some last-minute things that happened, as you saw. But, I mean, we sold out everything we brought. So
great.
Pretty much in order to make independent printing, you know, self-publishing printing work, I kind of have to print the next issue in conjunction with shows that I'm going to do. So like for example, we're definitely going to do like MegaCon in Orlando this year.
Oh.
We always do Baltimore every year. Mm-hmm. Other shows we're looking at doing maybe Heroes in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. We've got some that we're looking at in New York, some different ones, and just all over the place. Philadelphia, maybe we'll go out as far as Chicago. We're really just trying to branch out, but I have to like kind of time the printing and stuff like that with a show so that I can move enough of the printed material to afford to print the next book, basically.
Great.
At least for now. So because of the speed at which we work, like, for example, this year we plan on putting out 3 issues.
Okay.
In the first arc, there is 7 issues.
Okay.
So when you go in, let's say you go mainstream through like a comic book store, like when you go through Diamond, which is the main publisher for all comic book stores, you kind of have to have your comic book ready to go month to month. If you're not really ready to do that, at least for our feeling, it was best to kind of like do the show circuit and the indie circuit for a while and kind of just like, you know, self-print the books for now until we got enough issues where I knew that I could keep with a schedule. And when it finally goes mainstream to all comic book stores, maybe sometime, maybe we're about a year and a half away from that, that they'll just literally come out month to month. But when that happens, definitely we're going to change all the covers and stuff, so, and all those kind of things. So anybody who supported us and found us early on, they're going to have some pretty neat exclusive stuff, you know, that they were able to get this way. And mm-hmm. But then, yeah, eventually we do have hopes to go mainstream and put it out there, so then it'll be easy for every comic book store to get it. But for now, if you really like what you see on the website, you want us to be carried local to you, another way to do it would be contact your local comic book store and have them reach out to us. If you reach out to us on social media, which is right on our Tainted Love website, there's all kinds of ways to hit us up. We will hit you back. You know, so if a comic book store definitely reached out to us and said, hey, listen, people have been talking about your comic book. They want us to carry it at least a little bit in our store. I'll definitely make it possible to have that happen and make it profitable for the comic book store and make it able, so you don't have to pay for shipping and all that stuff. You can just go right to your local comic book store and pick up the book and all that.
Cool. Now, don't want to get too far off the subject of the characters and the books, but have you guys considered digital?
Yeah, so the origin story that we're talking about that's online is sort of already a sort of a digital way to at least tell that part. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking about releasing the issues digitally so people can just pick them up. We're exploring that now. We almost did it about 8 months ago, and we kind of held off because we really wanted at least three issues out before we really just did the digital launch. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're really close to that, doing that, making that happen.
Okay. So when you do digital, you're basically on a bookstand with everybody else out there. You have just as much space as Action Comics and stuff like that.
Yes,
if you're on
the customers that do digital, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm old school in that way. Like, digital is really hard for me. And even though I made something digital that I put online, like, it's hard for me to be as excited about comics in the way that I'm very tactile. I need a printed book in front of me. I love to feel it and read it and experience it. For me, even the way pages turn has a certain way in which story is told. Mm-hmm. We specifically made it to work that way. Mm-hmm. So, like, digital, it's something I'm warming up to. Okay. I'll tell you that. I'm warming up to it. But I definitely know, I mean, back in the day, this was back in that early 2000s, I used to own a comic book store in Florida.
Oh.
And so I've been around a lot of comic book people, and I know what they would buy and stuff like that. And definitely I would say the lion's share of my customers would not have read a comic book online. They would only want to buy it printed. So even though I feel like there's a huge, huge market for digital, and I definitely think it's growing astronomically, and I think soon it could really make, I mean, the more people that are reading them on Kindles and iPads and things, that these are people who maybe never even read comics and they're reading them digitally. I feel like the accessibility there is wonderful, and I'm very excited about it. In another sense, I feel like there is still that main-based comic book reader that is still going to want that printed book, and so to me, it's almost like two different markets. Maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe I've been out of it too long, and I'm not really understanding it quite right. But at least the way I see it, like, I definitely am going to make it available digitally. But to me, I'm very true to my roots, and I got to have that printed book. And so that's my first goal is always, how do I get this printed book to be on a newsstand, to be at a comic book store, to get in your hand for you to buy and read, you know, those kind of things.
Well, I have a lot of friends who love to get their stuff on iPads and stuff because they say the color is so much brighter and more profound on an iPad, let's say. And so John's art would stand out a lot on an iPad.
Yeah, it's probably even different. I mean, John will probably speak to that at the end, but mm-hmm. I do know that we have a lot of issues with color when you go to print. Mm-hmm. You know, the way color is made in a lot of programs on computer screens is completely different than how it comes out in print. And he's definitely – a lot of times – sometimes he's saddened by – how much a color will change or how much detail he put into something that you can't really see in its 100% totality in print. So I'm right with you. Mm-hmm. I'm right with you.
Okay. Well, let's get back to the characters. Why don't you tell us who the main couple are? Who are these people?
Okay. Well, so the main couple is Daniel and Sarah. Mm-hmm. And Sarah is, weirdly enough, I kept her as a nurse. She is still kind of a nurse. Mm-hmm. And Daniel has, you know, like an office day job. And they were, you know, I dare I say a normal couple, but they were more normal and PC than less normal. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they would be the kind of couple, I guess you would want to put it, that would never think about killing somebody or harming someone in that way, or even know what to do with it if they were forced in that situation. Mm-hmm. So when this basic couple experienced what it is that happened to them to make them what they are, you know, it was very traumatic. It wasn't exciting and romantic. It was traumatic. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of getting used to before we finally got to the place where they felt comfortable with it. Now, for all intents and purposes with the comic book, so we'll just stay, let's say, with the comic, what's in print. Mm-hmm. We've already kind of passed all those stages. We're kind of at the place where we've moved past all the early denial and all that stuff, and we're kind of at the place where they've accepted what they are, and they're learning to maybe even move past acceptance into having it just be, this is what is their normalcy now. Mm-hmm. And maybe what they also don't, maybe to let go of guilt, I guess is what I mean. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what that'll make them when they do that. But mm-hmm. to me, that was kind of more exciting and fun to tell in at least the first seven issues in the comic book. There will be glimpses of the past, so you'll be able to feel what that was like for them before and how different their relationship has changed from mm-hmm. before. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're kind of jumped ahead a little bit with them. And so they've kind of already worked out about half the kinks. Like, they figured out, how do we make work still? How do we figure out our work schedule with the problem of having the shortcomings of what vampirism brings with it? Or how do we, you know, those kind of things.
Well, what I get a kick out of is in the first book, they have in the very beginning a very intimate setting where they're talking to each other, and something about their past actually comes out in there, and it's a very serious moment for a minute. And he talks about, Daniel says about the fact that he's not jealous, but then once that's over with, then he goes out and let's just say that he resolves that situation. And I don't know how much detail you want to go in about this, because I want people to read the book, but it has to do with somebody that she's interacted with in the past.
Okay, so I mean, just because Daniel's a vampire doesn't mean he can't be jealous. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what I was trying to show right out of the gate, that at first glance, you can't even tell you're dealing with vampires. You can't tell that there's anything different or off about them per se. It sounds like maybe a conversation, I don't know, maybe you could have had, or you know people that could have had it. It wouldn't have raised any bells, you know? Mm-hmm. And once you start to see how it unfolds and plays out, maybe even what Daniel chooses to do about it maybe isn't so far off from how you feel you would want to deal with the situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe you would never deal with the situation the way Daniel's going to deal with his situations, you know, and make the choices he makes. But I definitely think people can relate to feeling a certain way mm-hmm. after learning things and learning truths you didn't necessarily know, or feeling hurt or disappointed or feeling betrayal, or all the different things you can go through in your life, you know, mm-hmm. that can bring you to make more harsh reactions or decisions. I mean, that's the same thing, like, just because they're vampires doesn't mean they don't worry. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they aren't scared. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they don't feel pain. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they don't get happy about, or they don't still love their mother. I don't know. It doesn't mean all those things. It just means that this other facet of you is also true. It means that you have to kill to survive. Mm-hmm. And I guess at some point you might have to be okay with it. I mean, I can only imagine that over time, even if you weren't okay with it, some part of you, you would have to become numb to it, I would think. Mm-hmm. At first, yeah, it would be really traumatic. Mm-hmm. Especially after you killed somebody and then you realized, well, the bodies just don't magically disappear. What are we going to do with the leftover? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so different than how we would think. To me, it was almost kind of playful in the sense that, like, when I would think about it at night, I'd lay in bed, you know, with my wife, and I'd think about this, I'd be like, well, my wife has to eat at certain times or she gets really cranky, mm-hmm. you know? So, I mean, like, there's certain things that I was like, man, this is completely not practical. Like, what would I do if I was stuck in this situation? And I kind of felt like, man, we come from a very fast food society where I don't always want to have to make my food. Like, sometimes I just want to go out and sit down at a restaurant and order something and have somebody else have to deal with that. In this case, man, you have to not only make your own food, man, you got to go kill the cow first. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to, and it's not just a cow, you know, like it's not like, we just get it as a beef patty, so we don't have to think about the cow that was slaughtered. I mean, in this case, you have to go murder somebody that's a person. I mean, it's just so much extra, you know, and you're going to do it with what, your teeth? I mean, and even so, then, like, what would you do about your, you know, paying your bills and stuff? You'd have to still have a job. I mean, just because you murdered somebody in the street doesn't mean you now your bills are covered. I mean, if you think about it, in all practicality, if somebody just robbed you in the street, how much are they going to get out of you? I mean, most of us don't even carry cash. Mm-hmm. So they might get some cash. They might get a few credit cards. I mean, if they rob somebody at their house, they might be able to, what, sell their TV in a pawn shop? I mean, you're not going to get anywhere with that. You might as well just worked a normal job. You would have made more money. Like, mm-hmm. this is not – you cannot sustain your life, you know, with that kind of stuff. I mean, and even so, most people who are going to rob somebody, they're not going to use their teeth. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to use something way more practical. So when you really think about it, like, it's much harder in a practical way than – any movie I feel has ever really shown. I mean, you know, yeah, even if you give them superpower, you make them super strong, or, you know, all those kind of things and that kind of thing, or I guess even if they could turn into a bat, I guess, and fly or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, even so, it just doesn't fix these practical real-world problems that would just arise if you had to deal with this. And to me, that was the real fun of playing with it, mm-hmm. you know, and telling that kind of story. And I feel like that story, I want to say, hasn't really been done, but, you know, I mean, there's so many vampire stories, and I confess to you right out of the gate, I'm like, you know, because I'm not a huge fan of the genre per se, like, I haven't read, you know, 100 vampire books and all that stuff, so I'm sure elements have been used in different ways and stuff, but it's still, at the end of the day, the story is still kind of my style and tone, mm-hmm. and I feel like, at least in that way, if people find connected to me as a writer, connected to the way, like, John tells story with his imagery and stuff, at least that way is at least personal and our own. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean,
Well, it's more realistic. It's more realistic to me. It's because, you know, a lot of times the vampire stories are back in castles and they're, you know, back in the 1800s and stuff like that. To see something that was very realistic, at the end of the book, you know, he's fed and he's got blood all over his chin and mouth. And he goes into a store to buy cigarettes. And, of course, he orders a pack of Reds. And the guy behind the counter, and a little bit of humor gets thrown in, he says, "Dude, you got red on you." And I got a kick out of that because, you know, he's clearly oblivious to the whole thing. And the guy behind is actually trying to be funny with them and stuff like that. So I got a huge kick out of that. There's even some humor involved in this because that's the way things go in the real world. We see things that are funny and people comment on them and things. So I like that about it. It had a real sense of today and what would happen if the vampires were brought into today's world.
Yeah, well, also guys in gas stations and stuff like that have just really seen it all. So, you know, at night when you're working the graveyard shit at a gas station, somebody walks in like that, you're just not going to say anything. You just don't want a gun put in your face, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they've seen it all. So I figured, like, you could kind of play on that. And it was fun, and people would allow for it.
Now, there's something at the end of the first book that I wanted to bring out about the fact that he's fed, and we talked about the fact he has a little blood over his and his lower part of his face. He goes back to Sarah. And just something that I've never seen in vampire stuff before. Now, granted, I'm like you. I've seen vampire stuff, and I wouldn't call myself an expert on it. But she actually feeds on him because he's fed. And I hadn't seen that before. And I don't know whether you have, but that kind of surprised me. I was, you know, she gains strength and energy from what he has done. And I thought, boy, that if anything's going to make this a more intimate thing, it's going to be things like that.
Yeah, and I don't know how long that feeding could sustain her. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, that gets into, I guess, technicalities of how the book will play out. But yeah, I figured that in a pinch, you in a self-sacrificing, loving kind of connection could do something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Who knows how I come up with some of this stuff? I don't know. But, I mean, it hasn't been done before. I don't know. I mean, I always imagine, like, I mean, I'm assuming out there somewhere, you know, you have different kinds of romance novels and that kind of stuff. I mean, we live in the 50 Shades of Grey type land. So I'm assuming there's somewhere out there, there must be, you know, vampire romance novels. And out there, man, vampires must be biting each other all over the kind of thing. So I don't know. I'm not going to try to take claim to being the first at the table for anything. Mm-hmm. I just feel like maybe, you know, maybe as a cook, you know, I have my own chef and my own way to mix the spices and mix it in a certain way that makes the dishes that I like, I guess, is a better way to think of it. I definitely don't want to necessarily take credit for something or say I was the first to do a thing a certain way. I mean, actually, other people would have to tell me that because, like I said, I'm honestly not versed enough in it to know that way, because not that it isn't exciting or interesting. The vampire stuff, it can be fun, but there's so many other elements or factors that really is what draws me to the way I write the story that I don't want to make it sound like I also hate vampire culture or stuff like that either. It's not that either. It's just I would be more of a novice in that way. I'd be new to the vampire group. People would have to indoctrinate me in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, the second book, of course, you get into a lot more of the horrific stuff. Granted, the first one was horrific enough, you know, the feeding and stuff. The second book, you've alluded to the fact that what do they do with the bodies after they go out? We see some of that in the second book. And unfortunately for the neighbor, he walks in on some of that. And I felt really badly for him. The way that Daniel acted, I was reminded like a teenager. Like if a teenager was doing something, like they were smoking pot or something in a building, and all of a sudden some guy walked in, you know, they'd be mad at the person for catching them rather than trying to say, oops, I shouldn't have done this. And his response reminded me very much of that, that you, when you talked about the fact that they're kind of new to this whole business, they're still acting like they're young in all this new experience. So when they see, they, instead of being, oops, I shouldn't have done that, they are angry at the person that catches them.
Well, you could say he's new to being caught. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to say at this point now, to be fair to them, they probably have only been vampires for about 6 months.
Okay.
But if you had 6 months of straight killing, I would think at some point you would at least be different than the first month would be brutal and rough. Mm-hmm. You know, I always imagine like even if, you know, I mean, the first month you're a surgeon doing surgery. That first month might be a little rough, you know, and you're going to be doing things you've never done before, have to do whatever. And you may have a lot of doubts about whether you had the ability to do things or if you lost a patient, even if it wasn't your fault, you know, you'd have that guilt that would ride on you. But I mean, after you've been doing it for 6 months, a year, I'm not saying it would be easy, but it would be easier.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the getting caught part, I want to say like tonally, though, it also is a little bit like he's already accepted what they are. What they're doing to him isn't necessarily wrong anymore. Mm-hmm. Not wrong in the truest sense of the word. Mm-hmm. But more like, well, if this is just how we're made, even if you want to say because God did this to us or whatever you want to blame or whatever you want to say it happened, and you finally just decide, well, God, if you've abandoned me and this is how you've made me, then I guess this is what I am, then I'll just accept what I am. Mm-hmm. At some point, they've accepted what they are, and so getting caught angers him because the world can't understand what he is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you could say he killed these innocent people, but maybe he chose them because they're really old. Mm-hmm. And that for some reason, that logic resonated with him. Not that killing older people would be a fair thing to do or a good thing to do by any means, but that somehow they have to come up with maybe some kind of system mm-hmm. that they decide, well, how do you even choose who you're going to prey on? Mm-hmm. You know, and could we prey on each other's friends? I mean, where's the line? Like, I mean, they still have relationships. They still have things that they had. And I think, honestly, all they really have at the end of the day, what allows Daniel to be okay with what he does, and maybe what allows Sarah to be okay, is because they have each other. Like, maybe if Sarah was alone or if Daniel was alone by themselves, they just wouldn't have been able to do it. You know, maybe Daniel would have been like, well, I'll just give up the ghost and I'll just go jump off a ledge or something. I don't know if that would have done it. But you know what I mean? Like, he's like, I'll just quit. It's not worth living. But because there's Sarah mm-hmm. and he has to care for her, then maybe it keeps him going on. And definitely the same is true, honestly, maybe even more so for Sarah caring for Daniel. Honestly, I think when you see the way the story plays out, man, Sarah has to clean up a lot more of Daniel's messes and not so much the other way around. I think if of the two, Sarah definitely wears the pants in a relationship, so... Yeah, there's that.
Okay.
Now, when the going gets tough, Sarah has to step in.
Sarah gets going. Okay. Okay. Now, so you did one other thing in the book, too, and then I'll talk to John. And I don't know if this is related or not, but you guys start your books on the inside cover. Most comics start on what we call page one, which is on the right. You know, yours, you start your thing on the inside cover, which to me kind of yanked us in. And it was like, it's like we have to hurry. We have to get to the story so fast. It's on the inside cover.
So... kind of, because if you, especially in issue one, the way the dialogue reads, mm-hmm. it's basically like a camera where you're panning down into the shot. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing happens in issue two. If you look at it, the panel starts in the really, because you have to read the title and where the words are and stuff, it almost is cinematic in the sense of the camera starts in the sky and pulls down into the shot to pick up the dialogue from one to another. You maybe even see the dialogue bubbles before you see who's saying it, meaning maybe if it was cinematic, you would have heard someone talk off screen before they were on screen and you knew who it was saying it. Mm-hmm. And even so, even in page one, we hear the response to what that first person says, and that person's not on screen. So that's definitely an off screen dialogue that mm-hmm. you would have heard, at least in a cinematic sort of way. Mm-hmm. But John can kind of speak to the way the pages are and the storytelling and more like the inspiration of why we chose certain mm-hmm. decisions about the book. There's very specific kind of rhythm mm-hmm. and a system to our book, and John definitely is going to be able to speak to that much, much stronger than I can. I mean, together we came up with it, but mm-hmm. and we have a lot of the same loves, but John's storytelling is just fantastic, and I think he'd be a better answer to that.
Okay. John Hernandez, how are you?
How's it going, Wayne?
Good, good. Why don't we talk a little bit about that? The layout of the mm-hmm. book and stuff like that, with the starting things on, like the inside cover and thing, was that something that, you know, artistically that appealed to you? Because it sounds like the two of you came up with that together. It gives me a sense of urgency. You know, we have to hurry to get to the story, unlike most books, page one, they call it, on the right side. Was that something you were trying to communicate?
Well, I read a lot of books. As a guy, I read a lot of Marvel books, and I always liked see all the different approaches they would do to that. We call it the zero page. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they just do like write-ups and recaps. And hey, we're starting our new story, so we couldn't really do recaps. But I liked it when they had like some original art in there, or like they would draw something special, even if they were just recapping something or introducing that issue's characters to you and any new characters. And they do a little doodle in there. And I wanted to have that kind of feel. And then as I did more of it, they would get bigger and bigger, and through trials and testing, it actually ended up filling up the whole page, and they're like, let's just start, why wait? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is for that cinematic feel and to pull you in. We do stage it and storyboard it much like you would a film, and so I think it's a nice nod to that.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk to me about the characters. As you go through them, are these people based on people you know? Are they based on maybe some kind of a television? You know, maybe some are people you know, some are people you see on the TV, some are like stereotypes or things we see a lot. How do you choose what the people are going to look like?
we try not to draw people that we know.
Old Country Buffet.
Oh, are we going to tell them about the Old Country Buffet? So when David and I did a lot of our work, like, he works elsewhere in Virginia, we meet once a week. And a lot of times we did a lot of our storyboarding and story planning out at restaurants. Mm-hmm. And we're not the richest of people right now. And sometimes we just like to eat a lot. And we need a place that we can just sit and stay and be left alone, where people are not trying to kick us out the door. Mm-hmm. And we ended up at an Old Country Buffet. And we, I won't lie, a lot of the people in the background and a lot of the people who get eaten in our book might be people from the Old Country Buffet.
I can tell you a quick story, really funny. It's funny you say that, because I used to live in that area. I lived up in the Maryland side of things. And I used to belong to a script writing group. And we were writing fan fiction, fan scripts for, like, say, Star Trek shows, like the original series. And the place we used to go to almost every Saturday night was Old Country Buffet in Laurel. Laurel, Maryland.
That's the place where all the creativity happens.
That's really true. So how did you pick out the main characters, like Daniel and Sarah? How did they, was that just, was that inspiration struck you somehow? How did you pick out what they were going to look like?
I think when David designed them, well, when he came up with the conception, he really saw them as an everyman and an everywoman. And I kept trying to figure out, like, well, what do you want them to look like? And he just always kept keeping it very broad. So when I went down to pick it, I also tried to pick something a bit more generic and everyday, like some classic protagonists. But I will say there's a little bits and nods of them that I think remind me of David and his wife, and I try to put it in there. If people were to meet them, they and look at Daniel and Sarah, and they could be like, in a way, like if you had to do the Hollywood casting of them, like,
because
it would look kind of like
funny.
That's
how that happened.
That too.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk about you go from different styles even within the book. When it's more normal, things are happening, it's almost like a regular comic. But then when we start to go into where some of the more horrific things happen, it goes to a more painted feel, and the choice of color is a lot darker, for example. And like in the first book, when Daniel goes out to clear up a certain mess, that's a lot more blue and a lot more darkness and browns and stuff involved with it. And, you know, of course, what that does is that elicits the horror in it. You know, if you're in the dark and you can barely see, that's the kind of thing you'll see. And even when he goes into even late at night when he goes into the shop to buy the cigarettes, it's not quite bright in there. It's like a dark bluish.
Yeah, all the different scenes I really try to make have their own lighting and color palette to them. And definitely when we started the opening of the book, it's a much more of a romantic feel and a palette and warm and inviting sense that you would see in a movie scene where they're being intimate and laying in bed. And, you know, as the sun goes down, more sinister things happen. And it is a little bit of a nod to vampire stories. And it's like, maybe they only become vampires at night. And, like, it is not a coincidence that he leaves, like, right as the sun is going down. So the reader initially wonders, like, what are the rules that these vampires play by? So we like to tease them and play with their expectations. And as the second issue opens, it answers that question. Like, mm-hmm. can they be in the sun? Mm-hmm. What's their relationship to that? And they even talk a bit about how they learned it. And there's mm-hmm. a nice little discussion about that, too.
There are three pages in the second book. Well, there's two sets of them. But the first one is when they discover the body. And the color is very dark brown, with some interesting lighting coming in from a window. And then on the next two pages, there are times where you can almost can't see what's going on in the background and stuff like that, which I just, you know, because this is supposed to be, the police are there, and normally in a case like that to be well lit, but it gives you a sense of, like, the horror that they're feeling. You're communicating their feelings by using this dark, dark palette that's going on. And I just kind of was like, you know, I felt shivers when I was looking at that. I thought, wow, this is really, even the police are normally very, you know, used to this kind of stuff. Even they, you can tell you're communicating, are shaken by what they're finding.
Yeah, it is. It's much more for dramatic effects. Maybe perhaps in a more realistic crime scene, they would set up lights everywhere. But, like, they're really fresh onto that scene, and it makes the house feel dead. Like, that literally a death has happened in there. And there's very much a sense of Barnes the detective walking through that scene. his movements echo that of Daniel. Like, he ascends the stairs, and he's probably mentally in his head looks and thinks about, like, what was the killer thinking about, and then imagining and deducing, like, where the bloodstains came from, how they got there, and then descend the stairs as well. And it's a nice little mirroring of it. So the palettes and the treatment of the lighting, you know, that's not a coincidence.
So how did you get involved with this? It sounds like David came up with the concept a long time ago. Did he find you and recruit you into it? You guys were local. You knew each other.
How did Essentially, you get involved? Okay. We actually knew each other for a long time. We went to high school together. Quite a bit. We had the same art teacher. I had a comic book club, and he was a member of my comic book club. I'm only a few years older than him, and it was always my dream to do comics. And as high school goes and college goes, you lose touch. But pretty much 10 years after graduating high school, we ran into each other again, and he told me, it's like every time he goes to a comic book shop, and he even had a comic book shop of his own, he'd look for my books. And like, you know, where are those John Hernandez comic books that are always going to happen? And I had kind of lost touch with it, and I didn't know if I was going to do comics. I always wanted to. I became a graphic designer, and I did other things. Worked on video games, and then I thought, why did I never do that? And then as we kept talking, and we looked at some old stories, and we decided to find one of Dave's scripts, and which one of these appeals to us, which one of these is ready to go, and we can really show off our storytelling. And Tainted Love was, you know, the most developed story and the one we had the best ideas from, and we picked that one up and we ran with it, and we're two issues in now. So
great,
cool. Going pretty good.
Very cool. Of course, now you lead to the question. I don't know whether you or Dave are going to be the best ones to answer. Well, first thing I want to just take a look back. You guys got the Best Indie Comic Award for the Geeky Awards back in 2013, and you were nominated for the Best Comic as well. And so that must have been great. Were you there when the awards got presented? Were you there to pick it up?
We were. They had a I think it's still online on YouTube somewhere. Ken Pisani won Best Comic, but we were there at a table. But we were at the table with all the writers and all the other comics that were around. So yeah, we were there. It's great. I never thought I'd walk a red carpet in my life. So it was definitely a new kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, now, next question. You've alluded to it. We've got two issues done. There's a 7-issue arc in the first arc. How is issue 3 coming along? Do you guys have any estimation as to when issue 3 might hit the stands or be able to become available when you go to cons?
That one's for MegaCon, right?
Some of it, again, has to do with the con schedule. So, the first real cons, like, let's say next year would be, because we need about 4 months an issue is where we're at. So it kind of puts us, unfortunately, like the next big cons might hit around like March timeframe, unless something pops up before that. So we're going to try to do like two at a time. So like we'll try to print enough where we can do like two big shows and kind of get through a lot of that product so that we can then gear up for the next one. So our idea was we would release issue 3 around March, even though it'll be finished probably long before that. But then the next one would be like MegaCon, like in May and end of May, beginning of June for Heroes. And then, you know, the fifth one, if issue 4 comes out then issue 5, we'd be looking for maybe end of September, like we're talking Baltimore and, you know, maybe around the same time, like New York cons going, stuff like that.
Oh, great, great. Any estimation as to when we're going to have the whole first arc put together?
So, yeah, so if we finish 3 this year, the last 2 will be done maybe – it won't take a whole year, you know. So we're looking – we're maybe about a year and a half or so away. We're probably, you know, summertime, maybe even as soon as like summertime in 2018-ish.
Okay. I don't know. That's good. Well, it's worth the wait. It's a great comic. I enjoy, I think, both the art and the writing. It's one of those things when they work well together, it's magic. You know, you forget where you are and you dive in and you all of a sudden you realize when you get to the end of the comic, oh my gosh, I'm back in my hotel room. Or I'm back in Sunset. And that's when I read the book, so we were back in the hotel room and I was like, wow, I said, this is a really engrossing book. And that's why I saw it the one night at Baltimore, Richard Vera, who was working on his booth with him, and he took him back to the hotel room and I sat and read them. The next day I said, I got to set these guys up for an interview because these are really great books.
I appreciate that, Wayne.
And so I highly, when number three is about to come out, if you can somehow get me, I don't know if you make a promotional PDF or something like that. I used to be married to the paper copies, but I'm not so much anymore, especially if people...
Yeah, that's no worries. Yeah, that's no worries. Send me one of that. Kick you stuff direct. That's no problem.
Yeah, I'd like to, and I'll write a review about it because I think people should know about it. As doing this will help, I think, but I also would like to write a review whenever that comes out because it's great stuff. It's really different from the Vampire Run, so I like that.
I really appreciate that, Wayne. Really do.
You guys are doing great stuff. Now, let me ask you, of course, how do we keep up with what you're doing? You guys, it's taintedlovecomic.com is the place for the comic. Are there other projects you guys are working on we should be aware of?
So, yeah, you're going to see maybe a couple other things over maybe even this year that might peak up. You'll see at the show. We did show off this year at Baltimore. We had some images from another project that's being worked on called Project Drift, which is like a sci-fi racing type story. Mm-hmm. We have other type stories. I mean, John and I have known each other for so long. I mean, God, it's more than, I don't even want to say how many years, but 25 years. But we have so many stories that even when we were kids, we started to tell together that were fun, that have kind of matured over the years to still be stuff. Maybe some of those are still even worth telling. I've been telling a lot of my own stories. I wrote screenplays for like 8 years, so I have a ton of stuff that I wrote. Most of it not horror related at all, but just all kinds of different things. And John has his own stories that he kind of told in college and started building on over the years. And, who knows? I mean, we have a lot of different ones that we're talking about, but there's, you know, some main contenders that are kind of sitting in the main reserves. I guess what it really need to do next, potentially, is maybe find an artist that would like to take on Tainted Love after issue 7 so that I can free up John to work on other projects, because some of his stories are just fantastic, and I would love to see him tell some of those, but it just takes so much time for his style to work on Tainted Love that it kind of landlocks us into one thing, and the problem is we have so many other stories we want to get out there, so I really want to free him up and maybe put some other artists on other things so that I can get him freed up to tell his stories, and maybe we'll tell some more stories together and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, definitely you're going to see quite a few different things coming from C5 Studio.
Okay, so that's the name of the studio. Is that the both your guys' studio? Is that John? How does that work, C5 Studio?
Yeah, that's ours. It's our studio that we started.
You guys have a website. It looks like it's c5studio.com now.
It is.
Yes, it's mostly my art for that right now. Like, that had been a long time. I've been trying to make comics for a long time, and then it kind of just shifted into like a design thing and an illustration thing. But C5 Studio's first comic book is Tainted Love, and that's we branched off with its own site.
But C5 Studio has existed. I mean, literally, he created the C5 Studio name and was running on it maybe since as early as maybe 93.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
right out of high school.
It's been around a long time, and definitely the early days of the interwebs, C5Studio.com was always his, because he was right up there, front and center. You know, so that's why we have that. But because there's quite a few other C5 Studio type things out there doing different stuff, but in a lot of ways, I mean, he was the original. So and together we share it as our platform going forward, as our publishing company, to bring forward all our stories that we want to tell.
Now, you guys are on Facebook and Twitter, right, as well?
Yes, definitely.
C5 Studio and both those. I think on Facebook it's c5studio.art is our public page, where you can follow the comic and all the book releases and stuff.
Very cool. Well, you know, of course, this is the perfect month to buy Tainted Love. The holidays are coming. You never know if you've got a horror fan. These might be the things. And, of course, like you were saying, there are posters you can buy, things that you can do to support the comic moving forward. So taintedlovecomic.com. Go out there and check out the stuff. Support the comic and make some more of this happen, because I really enjoy it, and I hope we get to see a lot more from you guys in the near future.
Thanks so much, Wayne. We appreciate you, man.
Thanks, Wayne.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast, so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for this week. Please be back next time when I'll be speaking with another great comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.